Welcome to this class, The Empty Way, Contemplative Christianity and Zen Buddhism. This is Brian Taylor, and this is the first of a series of audio postings that I'll be doing for the course. In this course, I'll be talking about some various areas of overlap between the two traditions, contemplative Christian and Zen Buddhist, and as well as talking about practice and hopefully your own practice as you undertake or continue a regular time of meditation or contemplative prayer most days. I'll be talking in this course about themes that overlap, themes that repeat and overlap each other and reappear later under a different heading, because really we're really going to be dealing with not seven different subjects or ideas or even experiences, but one experience. And that one experience is the one reality which Buddhists call Buddha nature or enlightenment, and Christian contemplatives might call it union with God or perhaps the kingdom of God or the kingdom of heaven. I won't be attempting to be comprehensive about both traditions. This is not a survey course or an overview of two different religious traditions. That would be impossible, at least for me. And I'm not going to try to be comparative between the two. One says this and the other says that, and exploring the differences. I'm really looking at areas of overlap that I've found in my own study and practice over time, with a special focus on the experiential, so it's not just theoretical. We'll be using Robert Kennedy's book, Zen Gifts to Christians, and this first week, we're looking at the introduction in the first chapter. In the introduction, he talks a little bit about his own personal history, and so I wanted to introduce you to mine too a little bit. I've always been drawn to meditation, to silence, to monastic expressions of the Christian faith, whether that's through history, starting with the Desert Fathers, or even in my own time of retreat, going to various monasteries around the country. Also through, I've been a student of Eastern traditions as well, and certainly of Thomas Merton, having read most of what he's written and taken a pilgrimage to Gethsemane, the place where he was for so long. I'm probably one of those that Kennedy describes in his book as emotionally disposed towards that form of spirituality. And I've practiced that and followed it through having spiritual directors and readings and my own retreats, and most primarily a practice of contemplative prayer. All of this orientation has led me to Zen some 25 years ago or so, first through reading and then through retreats and called sesshins in the Zen tradition. And for some 7 years, I did those sessions regularly at the Zen Center of San Diego. I would travel out there and go for these week-long sessions with a teacher by the name of Charlotte Joko Beck, or Joko as she was known. And in between those sessions, we would have individual consultation on the telephone, called Daisan or Dokusan in different traditions. In my parish, as a parish priest, we started doing contemplative group, a weekly meditation group, where we would teach some of the things we'll be introducing in this course. And that developed into what we call the Contemplative Center, which for many years in my parish had a couple of contemplative weekly groups, one during the day and one in the evening, but also speakers would come in for conferences and we would have a couple of different weekend retreats during the year at a retreat center in Albuquerque. I continued to attend Zen centers through the years and do so even today as I live in Chicago. And I've learned quite a bit from many teachers. I've found the Christian contemplative and Buddhist approaches to spirituality over the years mutually enriching. And so that's, I think, enough about my own personal background with these traditions. But let's turn then to the book, Kennedy's book, on Zen Gifts for Christians. He bases his book on the ox herding pictures. Now, these pictures are a kind of Zen iconography, if you will. They began in 12th century China, where Zen also originated. Buddhism had come from India, but Zen as a tradition within Buddhism developed in China, known as Chan, and then it moved from there to other parts of Asia, including Japan. And what the ox herding pictures do is that they provide 10 different pictures that illustrate something about the path to enlightenment. And there are captions that different teachers have used and poems that some teachers have written about each of the pictures and commentaries as well. And Kennedy is one more teacher in that long line since the 12th century of people who take these 10 pictures and use them as a way of illustrating the movement through the spiritual journey as a Zen practitioner. As Kennedy himself says in the introduction on page 5, no matter the illustration, the ox in the pictures stands for our true nature. The ox herder represents those in search of the truth about their deepest self, and the 10 pictures represent the successive steps one must take to realize one's true nature. So that true nature that he speaks of, that the ox represents and that the ox herder is seeking, could be called in the Zen tradition Buddha nature, enlightenment, and for people of faith, the ox could represent God, or perhaps the kingdom of God. And I just want to offer one word of caution that when he says the successive steps one must take to realize one's true nature, I'm a little cautious about those sorts of statements that, first of all, that things like this are in succession. Things don't necessarily happen in the order that spiritual systems lay them out. And secondly, the term, the steps that one must take in order to realize one's true nature, I'm not so sure that one must take this particular approach. So the first chapter is the picture of the ox herder who searches with all of his might for the ox. He searches with his whole being. As we approach meditation, we begin with the assumption that it takes practice, it takes commitment, it takes discipline, it takes time. And some of that discipline is actually physical in the contemplative and Zen traditions. That kind of commitment and discipline are necessary, I think, in order to cultivate our ability to focus, to pay attention with our whole being. No matter what we're trying to do that is really challenging, whether it's playing a musical instrument or learning to cook or something else, it takes discipline, it takes commitment, it's a challenge, and it takes time, and that's true with meditation. Meditation is unique in terms of its relation to the spiritual life because it can be a very focused place to actually learn experientially some of the truths of our spiritual life and how to deepen our faith. We learn as if the meditation time is a kind of workshop where the whole thing is condensed and the whole thing comes down to that little time that is unlike usually the way we move through the day, at least at first. And we learn a skill during that time, so that we can then apply that the kinds of capacities that are developed in a concentrated way during meditation, we can apply those in our daily life and learn how to be more present, how to be what many people call these days mindful. Now, why is it important to cultivate these abilities that come with meditation? Well, I think they help us to be more present in the moment, less apt to be anxious and attached, less caught up in our emotional dramas, whatever they are, whether they're subtle or extreme. We're less likely to be caught up in our interpretation of other people or events, less likely to be reactive and controlling. In short, what I'm describing is equanimity. And another word for equanimity is constancy. With constancy or equanimity, we're more apt to be sensitive to our environment, to others, and to their needs, to respond with clarity rather than reactivity, to have more gratitude and more peace of mind, and more capacity to love and to even serve the greater good with equanimity and constancy. But to develop this ability requires attention, and at least in the contemplative tradition, discipline, and effort, just like cultivating any skill does. But the kind of effort that's required is not willful, as if we're gritting our teeth and trying to make ourselves, trying to push ourselves into a certain state of mind, but in contemplation rather to be relaxed and awake, that kind of discipline. And also not trying to force thoughts out of our mind. We really can't do that. You talk to any meditation teacher and they will say that that will go on and, you know, as long as we're alive. I mean, that's what the brain does. It secretes chemicals which cause thoughts, and that's what happens all the time. Even in our sleep, we're coming up with thoughts that we call dreams. And so it's impossible to empty your head out, and that's not the point. As Robert Kennedy says in Zen Gifts to Christians, when he quotes the Zen master Bodhidharma, let the mind circulate freely, but let it cling to nothing. Let it circulate freely, let it cling to nothing. And so thoughts come and go like clouds across an empty sky, is another metaphor that is used. However, to persevere in this practice, it is difficult, and it requires discipline over time. Even if what we're doing is learning how to be relaxed and awake, that is not easy. It requires discipline because we have to keep doing it, and doing it regularly over a long period of time, just like learning to do anything requires time. What we get out of it is what we put into it, and that's true. Another way in which this practice is challenging is that I think we gain the most when we learn how to be attentive and awake to things that are not necessarily pleasant. It's easy to be mindful and awake and attentive when we're watching a beautiful sunset, or we're listening to a nice piece of music, or we're appreciating the light and the shadows the way they are on the wall, or the taste of delicious food. That's easy. What's more difficult is to be mindful or awake and attentive when things are not so pleasant. Emotional or physical pain, sadness, boredom, conflict, tension, stress, disappointment. But to bring awareness to these states, actual physical awareness without interpretation, to simply experience things as they are and to embrace them in the sense of allowing them to be there and approaching them with a sense of curiosity rather than trying to figure out them out or make them go away or label it as bad or something, but to simply feel what we are feeling and experience what we're experiencing with curiosity and an awake willingness is where the greatest benefit of meditation occurs. Because those states come up in meditation, as we learn to do them in this little workshop of meditation, we learn to practice that in daily life, so that if we're having an unpleasant feeling, whether it's physical or emotional, in meditation, and we simply sit through it with curiosity and openness and let it be what it is without interpretation, if we do that in meditation, we're more likely to do that with another person in a meeting. or a conversation that's unpleasant, to simply let it be what it is. Finally, part of the difficulty of contemplative prayer or zazen is physical. Unlike many Christian contemplatives or other forms of meditation, Zen emphasizes a particular posture that is upright, with a straight spine, and that is formal in the sense of undertaking a form. Now, some perceive this teaching and this expectation or the atmosphere of a zendo, which expects these things, as rigidity. And people rebel against rigidity. You know, who are you to tell me how to sit still? how to make my body during meditation? But there are several good reasons for the insistence on complete stillness and a particular posture of uprightness. And that is, first of all, it's extremely practical. It is the easiest way to be completely still for a half hour or more and to be relaxed without back strain and ultimately enormous pain. And the reason why stillness is important is that it simplifies the experience. We're normally distracting ourselves with little bits of movement. We cross our legs, we uncross them, we look around the room, we shift in our seat. These are little shifts of the mind along with the body. And when we ask ourselves to be completely still, physically, we have the opportunity also for our mind to become still. And when our mind is still, we can be more awake and have more equanimity. And when we're sitting upright and we're still, it's also the easiest way to remain awake, because some people get sleepy when they sit still. Shunryu Suzuki says in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, the most important point is to own your own physical body. If you slump, you will lose yourself. Your mind will be wandering about somewhere else. You will not be in your body. This is not the way. We must exist right here, right now. This is the key point. You must have your own body and mind. Lastly, a reason for this physical posture that's emphasized in Zen is that it embodies the Buddha. It is a kind of sacramental physical incorporation of the spirit of the Buddha, because the tradition has it that the Buddha sat like this, and everyone has ever since. It is a yogic practice in the sense of embodying something that is not tangible. It involves the whole body, including the breath. It's the physical act of becoming an upright, open, awake person. When we do that physically, we're more likely to do it mentally. So the teachings are not just in our head. It's a direct experience. In a sense, when we sit this way, the tradition says we become the Buddha. Shunryu Suzuki, again in Zen Mind, Beginner Mind, says, the physical posture of meditation expresses the key point of Buddhism. It is a perfect expression of your Buddha nature. These forms are not just a means of obtaining the right state of mind. To take this posture itself is the purpose of our practice. When you have this posture, you have the right state of mind. So there is no need to try to attain some special state. And Suzuki goes on further to say, enlightenment is not some good feeling or some particular state of mind. The state of mind that exists when you sit in the right posture is itself enlightenment. Well, I've posted an accompanying video for this posture for meditation, and also an audio file by Taigen Dan Leighton on posture and beginning steps towards meditation. And I would suggest that you familiarize yourself with this and try it out. Get comfortable with the mechanics of sitting, and you might pause the audio right here until you've done that, and then return to listening afterwards. So what follows is a guided meditation, which you can use as a way of moving into meditation and contemplative prayer as you go forward. Begin with the body. It is upright. The eyes are half open. The spine is straight. Hands are in the cosmic mudra position. You're alert and relaxed. Bring your attention to your breath. And if you're new to meditation, stay focused on the breath for a while until you get comfortable with that. It's also a good way to just begin any time of meditation for the first few minutes. If it helps you, you can count your breaths, you know, up to 5 or so, and then start again at 1. And for people of faith, we begin our time of contemplative prayer with a prayer of dedication, knowing that it is in God that we live and move and have our being. Recognizing this, asking for God's help and guidance, with the confidence that the Spirit is working at least as hard as we are in time of prayer. Gradually move your attention from your body outwards to your whole environment all at once, beginning with your breath and doing perhaps a kind of body scan with attention to any particular areas of your body that are tense, feeling your seat on the chair or the cushion, the air on your skin, the light in the room, perhaps even the objects in the room that are around you, and your peripheral vision, not casting your eyes around, but noticing your situation and the sounds that are in the room, just as there are sounds in the back room of this room where I'm recording right now. The ambient sounds, there are always ambient sounds. The whole world in which you sit is all there at once. It is what Buddhism calls suchness, the suchness of this moment. This whole environment is one thing, one constantly evolving subtle symphony of bodily sensations, your breath, the room in which you sit, the whole world. And as involuntary thoughts arise on their own, that's part of the suchness too. They're not the enemy, they're part of the total reality. As Shinryu Suzuki says about involuntary thoughts, when you are practicing Zazen, do not try to stop your thinking. Let it stop by itself. If something comes into your mind, let it come in and let it go out. It will not stay long. When you try to stop your thinking, it means you are bothered by it. Do not be bothered by anything. It appears as if something comes from outside your mind, but actually it is only the waves of your mind. And if you're not bothered by the waves, gradually they will become calmer and calmer. So different things will move through your consciousness. Involuntary thoughts, memories, plans for the future. Or maybe then your consciousness is awareness of breath or the physical environment. Let whatever is going on in your mind be only one instrument, as it were, in the great symphony of suchness. So that what you call me is only part of the whole. It is not the center. Consciousness, what we call the self, is only one element of the totality. And that consciousness is porous in meditation, transparent, integrated with everything else all at once. And so continue in this way in silence in your meditation or contemplative prayer for a while. If you're new to this, 10, 15 minutes, otherwise a half hour or so. And close your time with a prayer of self-offering, of thanksgiving.